Deep dive into the world of science with Nature Plus. From the vastness of the distant star systems to the intricacies of infectious diseases due to climate change, we've got you covered. Enjoy access to over 55 cutting-edge journals, breaking scientific news, and over 1,000 new articles every month. Whether you're a seasoned researcher or just curious, Nature Plus simplifies complex studies. Plus, it's all available right at your fingertips on nature.com. Nature Plus, the key to unlocking the world's most significant scientific advances. Subscribe today at go.nature.com/plus.
It can be hard balancing taking care of kids, senior loved ones, and yourself. Remember, it's okay to ask for help. There's a reason 29 million families have turned to care.com. Find background-checked sitters, nannies, and senior caregivers who can help with everything from watching kids after school to senior meal prep. Whether you need full-time, part-time, or even occasional help, you can view rates and book highly rated caregivers that fit your budget and schedule. Get the help you need with care.com.
Why is light so fast?
Like, it sounds so simple.
They had no idea.
But now the data speaks.
I find this not only refreshing, but at some level astounding.
Nature.
Welcome back to the Nature Podcast. This week, a protective gel that lets you post proteins.
And a plastic that you can compost at home. I'm Emily Bates.
And I'm Benjamin Thompson. First up then this week, I just wanted to introduce Emily Bates. You might have heard her reading the research highlights last week, but Emily is here to host the show for the first time. Emily, hi.
Hello, Ben. How are you doing?
I am doing A-OK. It's great to have you with us in the hosting chair for the first time.
Absolutely. Fantastic to be here. Looking forward to it.
Excellent. Well, let's start with our first story this week, which seems like the right place to do so. And we're all used to the idea of reaching into the fridge when we want milk for our tea or opening the freezer when we want some peas for our dinner. Now, these technologies help us store food for longer, so it's still fresh when we want it. And the same thing applies to many of our modern medicines. Protein-based therapeutics like insulin or antibodies used to treat cancer are often frozen or freeze-dried to keep them in optimum condition for when they reach their destination. But while these methods are effective, they can be expensive, time-consuming, and not conducive to low-resource settings. But this week in Nature, researchers are presenting an alternative way to get these vital proteins where they need to go. A gel that can store them that is quick, simple, and cheap. Reporter Anand Jagatia spoke to one of the paper's authors, Matthew Gibson, about the research and started by asking him to explain what goes wrong with proteins if they aren't stored properly.
Protein isn't alive. It's essentially a big macromolecule. Piece of spaghetti, if you like, that folds itself into a structure that then gives the function which we all know proteins can perform. So really it was about how do you stop them from unfolding, but in particular, how do you stop them from aggregating? So one protein on its own will normally function, but when they start to stick together with themselves, you find that they lose a bit of their activity or they become insoluble. And this is made worse by shaking them. So one of the most famous examples of this is in insulin. When you prepare it, if you shake it vigorously, that actually promotes this aggregation.
I think people will probably remember from the pandemic that there was a lot of talk about cold chain technology or cold chain management, and that it's not enough to create a vaccine or could be a protein or an antibody or whatever. You have to be able to store it and transport it. And so we do have ways of doing that, but it's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, so the cold chain works really well. Yeah, the example in COVID was the mRNA vaccines, for example. So not proteins, so a bit of an aside from what we've done. And one of the things when they first emerged was how everyone had planned for them to be delivered in minus 80 degrees C freezers. So these use an awful lot of energy. So your one minus 80 degrees C freezer can use as much as, say, someone who's living in a small house on their own.
So freezing proteins comes with considerable energy costs. Are there any other downsides to the way that we currently store proteins and other molecules?
Yeah, so the freeze-thaw process itself is pretty strenuous. Once frozen, things store well, but getting down to temperature and getting up to temperature is where an awful lot of the damage can occur. On some proteins, if you freeze-thaw them, you do get some aggregation. But really, the other really good way for storing proteins is freeze-drying. So a bit like with freeze-dried coffee, remove all the water, and then you got a nice, stable, solid powder. But it's a solid protein, and that's not what goes into someone. So you've got to crack open the liquid, get that into the solid, and you've got to dissolve it, and you've got to follow those instructions. So this is where we're wondering, what other technologies can we bring to it which are as universally useful as some of the freeze-drying and freezing methods, but are really, really simple, but have the benefit where the user doesn't have to decide how concentrated it would be by mixing different components together.
What was your approach then? How did you decide to tackle this problem?
So the way we tackled this was with our collaborators at Glasgow University, Professor David Adams. He's really an expert on making gelata molecules. So what we mean by this, gelatas are small molecules. When you put them in the right conditions, they sort of stick together and they form these big networks, and that stops the movement and it becomes a gel, a bit like a jelly. So by slowing down the molecular motions within the gel, the proteins won't come across each other, and then we can switch off the aggregation.
So if I sort of try and scale this up by analogy to like human level, if me and you were sort of floating around in a big like swimming pool of jelly or gel, it would be quite difficult for us to move through it and to reach each other. And so we'd kind of just be stuck separate. Is that kind of what's happening with the gel and the proteins?
Exactly. So if we're in a normal swimming pool, if we just swam at random, we're going to run into each other eventually. If you and I try and swim in some jelly, it would take us a while to run into each other, and the frequency of that would be significantly decreased. But of course, then we've got the problem. We're going to want to get out of the swimming pool at some point.
So how do you get the proteins out of the gel then? How did you solve the second issue?
These gels, they have a unique property in that we'd say they're quite stiff. They're almost a bit brittle. When we push the gel out of a syringe with a small filter on the end, we sort of shatter the internal network of the gel. And as you push, none of the gel came out of the syringe. So all we got was pure protein in the salts and buffer.
So how did you actually go about testing the performance of these storage gels, and how well did they do at protecting the proteins?
We took an enzyme, it's called beta-galactosidase. We actually showed that if we even heat it up to 50 degrees C, we retain some of that protein function. And we also stored some insulin. We showed that when it's in our gel, if you shake it at 600 RPM, insulin that comes out is not aggregated. The experiment we were most proud of was we put a temperature tracker in with one of our gels, and we thought we'd subject it to a random test. So we just used the post. So we put these things in the post and sent them back to ourselves to collect them. We could see it's been through quite a range of temperatures. It's probably been dropped, right? We got dropped into a post box, and the protein we recovered was perfect. So that was the thing which made us most confident this worked.
Now you've done the proof of concept, what's next for your lab in terms of getting these gels tweaked and finalised and potentially out into the real world?
We can change the structure of the gels a lot, so we are looking a little bit to really make sure we're on the optimum gel and that we can use this in as many different types of protein as possible. So that's the first thing which we're really having to check. Also, the long term, so how far can we go? Is this for something that you might want to bank for 6 months, or is it 3 or 4 years?
And one of the potential areas where this could be really impactful is in low resource settings, you know, countries that where they don't really have reliable electricity. There's no way they're going to be able to keep a minus 80 degree fridge running constantly. And often they're the places where you need to send some of these therapeutic molecules.
This is really where we want to be looking at. So are there protein vaccines which would respond really well in our scenario, so they can be all dosed and metered at production. And then when they're sent to their final location, you don't need the high electricity storage conditions, but you also don't have the worry of transient warming events. And those combinations is where we really think for these low resource environments, yeah, for both human and maybe animal health as well.
That was Matthew Gibson from the University of Manchester here in the UK. For more on that story, check out the show notes for some links.
Coming up, how embedded enzymes could make plastic more biodegradable. Right now, though, it's time for the research highlights with Dan Fox.
In 2021, a huge cicada emergence had an unexpected knock-on effect. Extra raccoon activity. Cicadas are insects that spend most of their lives underground, only to emerge en masse at the end of their life cycle to reproduce. One of the largest emergence events in recent history occurred in 2021, when three cicada species on a 17-year cycle emerged in the space of just 2 months in the eastern United States. A team of researchers wanted to know what effect this emergence might have on the local mammal populations, and set up camera traps and audio recording devices across 2 areas of Indiana. The team looked at 8 species and found most of them carried on as usual during the cicada invasion. But raccoons became more active during the event, possibly so they could feast on the readily available insects. Meanwhile, white-tailed deer appeared less frequently, perhaps avoiding areas where the hum of insects could make it harder to hit predators. You don't need a camera trap to catch that research. It's in the Journal of Mammalogy. Records of the quality of annual wine grape harvests can be used to estimate historical summertime temperatures across Western Europe. Weather and harvest quality are interlinked. Grapevines like their summers hot and sunny, and their favourite weather leads to production of grapes with high sugar levels. A team of researchers analysed records of the sugar content of wine must, the mashed grape juice before it's fermented, in Western Europe from 1420 to 2019. Combining this analysis with climate records to build a model that estimates harvest quality, summertime temperature, and precipitation at locations where the wine was produced. Their analysis shows that the quality of grape harvests oscillated for more than 500 years before increasing sharply in the latter part of the 20th century, as human-induced global warming resulted in longer and hotter summers and better wine grapes. You can pick up that vintage research in Climates of the Past.
Next up on the show, reporter Nick Petrichow has been finding out about a new plastic that can biodegrade in a home compost heap.
I probably don't have to tell you that plastic waste is a huge problem, with millions of tons of the stuff being produced and thrown away every year. What's more, plastic often lingers in the environment for hundreds of years. To avoid a continued build-up of plastic rubbish, manufacturers have been increasingly turning to polylactide, or PLA, a plastic derived from plant materials that should completely break down over time, but only under certain conditions.
It is considered as biodegradable at high temperature, and high temperature means higher than 60 degrees.
This is Alan Marty, the chief scientific officer at the biochemistry company Carbios, who has been working to find a way to get PLA to biodegrade at lower temperatures. And this would be useful because currently this plastic can only be broken down in special industrial facilities. So PLA can't just be chucked onto someone's compost heap, as these don't get above 60 degrees. Alan and his colleagues have been investigating if enzymes could help break down PLA more efficiently. These little proteins have shown promise at breaking down plastics, and the team wondered if embedding an enzyme into PLA could reduce the temperature where it breaks down. There is evidence that this worked for other plastics, but while straightforward on paper, for PLA the reality was somewhat different.
When the CEO of Carbios 12 years ago proposed me this challenge, my first question was how to introduce an enzyme in a plastic, because I was not familiar with plastic industry. And the answer was, we will melt the polymer and we will introduce this enzyme. And my second question was, what is the melting temperature of the PLA? And the answer is 170 degrees Celsius. And I said, I think it will not be possible.
But Alan was not going to be defeated that easily. Previous studies have found enzymes that can break down PLA, but these wouldn't be able to withstand the high temperatures in the plastic production process. So the team set about looking for an enzyme that could. They started with a known PLA-eating enzyme that is found in a bacterial species, and then they isolated it and tried to figure out how to make it work a bit better, as Isabel André, part of the team from the University of Toulouse, explains.
And we started to engineer this enzyme. So that's where actually we used molecular modeling to understand how the PLA could be recognized by the enzyme and identify some residues that could be key and that actually could be mutated to improve the activity of the enzyme.
The team were able to find the key amino acids in the enzyme that they could change to improve how well it works. They then used this knowledge to make a beefed up version of the enzyme, which was great at breaking down PLA. Sadly though, it still couldn't survive the high temperatures that it would encounter during the plastic production process.
So that's when actually we decided to also search for homologs in the natural biodiversity. So we used bioinformatics tools to identify some enzymes, and we came up with an enzyme that was less efficient, but that actually showed higher thermostability.
So now the team had two similar enzymes, one that could break down PLA a bit but survive at higher temperatures, and one that couldn't but was very good at breaking down PLA. The next step was to combine them, to create a new enzyme that could do both. The team did exactly this and ended up with an enzyme that could break down PLA well and withstand the high temperatures. But then they were faced with a different problem. How do they get it into the plastic? Enzymes have been embedded in plastics before, but previous attempts have used enzymes in powdered form, which limits how thin the final plastic can be, making it difficult to use for things like shopping bags or food packaging. To get around this, the team introduced the enzyme into the plastic moulding process as part of a liquid formulation. This had a dual benefit. It mixed better in the melted plastic and further protected the enzyme from heat. With all that in place, the next question was how well the enzyme-infused PLA broke down.
What we proved is that, first of all, this plastic is only biodegradable in presence of water. It means that during the storage, there is no biodegradation at all. And then it is just when the plastic ends up in a compost, we demonstrate is that the total biodegradation is realized in less than 26 weeks.
When in warm, wet conditions, like a home compost bin, the plastic will break down in about 26 weeks. A big improvement over just regular PLA, which would still need a long time in special industrial conditions to break down. Ting Chu, a material scientist who's also worked on enzymes to break down plastics, was impressed by the research.
The work is definitely very important and has a lot of relevance for years to come.
Ting believes that being able to program when a plastic is broken down is going to be important to deal with plastic waste. And by embedding an enzyme, like the team did here, you can achieve that, and in a more efficient manner, by having dedicated enzymes to break down the plastic.
First of all, you really make the enzyme to be accessible to the plastic that is buried deep down, instead of just having a surface erosion. And the other thing is that you can have a lot of enzymes working at the same time for you, instead of just relying on whatever the environment have at the time. That's a really, you know, large variable. But by putting the enzyme inside of the plastic, you know where they are.
The one caveat Ting did have, though, was with this being an engineered enzyme rather than a naturally occurring one, she'd like to know what would happen to it in the long term.
So if they leach out to the environment, what is going to be their impact for the long term? Personally, I think they should be pretty safe because enzyme is not particularly stable. Nature may have different ways to deactivate, but that's the part, you know, I think the community probably should spend some effort to investigate on.
Alan and the team say that the enzyme will degrade in the environment, and recently they gained authorization for the product to be used in the United States, which means it had to go through various checks to make sure the enzyme is safe to use and doesn't transfer to food. In fact, come 2025, we may start to see this kind of enzyme-embedded PLA plastic available, which Alan thinks will really start to change how plastic waste accumulates.
For single-use plastic, I think this work is a revolution because it will enable to replace, for instance, polyethylene packaging, and you cannot imagine biodegradation with polyethylene. Then the challenge is to replace polyethylene by PLA, but this innovation offers a way to make packaging fully biodegradable.
That was Alain Marty from Carbios in France. You also heard from Isabella André from the University of Toulouse, also in France, and Ting Xu from the University of California, Berkeley in the US. For more on this story, check out the show notes for some links.
Finally on the show, it's time for the briefing chat, where we discuss a couple of articles from the Nature Briefing. Emily, why don't you go first this week? What have you been reading?
So I've got a story I read about in Nature, and it's based on a Nature Communications paper, all about making lab-grown meat actually taste, well, like meat.
All right, so lab-grown meat then. So this isn't fake meat, but it's also not real meat. How are we defining lab-grown meat here?
Yeah, so it's cultured meat. It's produced by growing animal cells in the lab. So normally they take stem cells and turn them into muscle cells, and that's what they use to create these, what we call lab-grown meats. Some people believe that this is the future of meat. There's no need to slaughter an animal, and it could in the future have a lower carbon footprint than rearing livestock does, if we can get the technology right.
And one of the things to overcome then is to make this lab-grown meat taste meatier, is that right?
So they've really focused on the texture and making it look like meat. So you get things like steak and meatballs. But matching the taste has always been quite challenging. The traditional meat flavours are very complex and they don't do particularly well in a lab setting.
Well, researchers are getting towards getting the look down then. But I guess a lot of eating is in the smell and the taste. And this has been hard to recreate the real deal then.
Yeah, so when conventional meat is cooked at high temperatures, it undergoes something called the Maillard reaction. And this is when amino acids and sugars react with each other. And it's what gives the meat that recognisable aroma and taste, and also that kind of golden brown colour that you get. You know, the crispy bits that make you go, oh, that looks quite nice, actually. So what the researchers have done is they've developed a compound that contains a product of the Maillard reaction that is known to contribute towards the sort of savoury profile of meat. And they made it what they call switchable, meaning that the flavour would only be released when the meat was heated to around 150 degrees C.
So there's kind of a mirror there too then. So almost the process of heating, of cooking, releases what it's supposed to taste or smell like, is that right?
Yeah, so they tested it by using what's called an electronic nose, which is a device that analyzes the chemical makeup of smells. And they found when they heated this lab-grown meat, it produced compounds that were associated with savory, fruity, and meaty flavors. But it wasn't until it's heated up. So before then, the nose was like, this is just some weird gel. Which is another thing we should probably talk about. They added this compound that they created to a hydrogel, which is a sort of jelly-like material that's used as the scaffold for the stem cells that they grow into muscle tissue.
Right.
It's what allows the sort of meat to begin. But it means that it's not the most appetizing looking thing in this situation. It kind of looks like a translucent pink gel disc. It doesn't scream of a hamburger or a steak or anything like that.
Mm-mm. So it seems then there's one strand which is getting it to look right and there's another which is getting it to taste right. Is it going to be straightforward to kind of combine the two things together?
Well, there's a slight issue with this study in that the materials and the culture medium that they used have not been approved as edible. So this meat isn't going to be used to nourish humans. It's not going to be the be-all and end-all, but it's just a proof of concept. And maybe in the future they'll be able to make it edible.
Well, that does seem like a fairly important bridge to cross then in terms of getting this lab-grown meat to look and smell like the real thing, as we say there. But let's move on to my story this week, Emily. And it's a story that I read about in The Guardian, and it's based on a paper in Nature astronomy, and it's about an underground cave on the moon. I think this has got a few people quite excited.
I wasn't aware that there were caves on the moon.
Well, that's totally reasonable, I think. And for a long time, researchers, you know, speculated that there was caves and tunnels under the lunar surface. It was thought then that this underground system was formed by lava flow, right, making these things called lava tubes. But there was no real direct proof, right? It was kind of hard to come by. Now, there have been a bunch of images of pits on the surface of the moon, right, at different elevations and different locations, several hundred of them, from what I understand. And it was kind of speculated that these were collapses of this underground network. But as I say, this has been kind of inconclusive. But that's where this paper comes in and have maybe kind of tipped the balance the other way a little bit.
Interesting. And so how did they actually discover this one? What was the process?
Well, in 2010, actually, this pit was detected by NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. Okay, and what the team here have done is they've actually gone back and reanalyzed some of the data from this mission, obviously several years later, and using new techniques. And what they've discovered is that there were some radar reflections from inside this pit. And they put forward that the likely explanation for this is that there is an underground cave. Now, it seems like quite a substantial sized thing, right? And it's accessible from this pit, which is in this area of the moon called the Mare Tranquillitatis, okay, the Sea of Tranquility, which is, of course, where the Apollo astronauts first set foot on the moon. And this is an ancient lava plain. And it turns out then that this cave, if that's what it is 150 meters below the surface, maybe 45 meters wide, and potentially up to 80 meters long. And in this article, they say that's about the size of 14 tennis courts. So a pretty big space.
So is this the kind of thing that we might be looking to set a base up on, or is that fanciful?
Potentially fanciful, but it's what a lot of people have been speculating for a lot of time. Before we get into that, let me do the sensible thing right now. I think researchers are super interested because the rocks inside this cave will probably be an absolute goldmine, if you'll pardon the pun, for the history of the moon and the volcanic activity there. But you're right. It seems that the way the wind is blowing is that humans want to set up bases on the moon. Now, the moon is a pretty inhospitable place. Right. We covered it on a book podcast not so long ago, so I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And, you know, there's these absolutely huge temperature swings. It's absolutely battered by radiation, and the threat of meteorite strikes is kind of ever present. So these geodesic domes on the surface that we were promised in the 1960s seemed very, very unlikely. But if you could live underground, that could mitigate a lot of these issues, right? Much more stable temperature, more protection from impacts and radiation. So that's what's been put forward. But it's always been tough to actually prove that these things are there and find one. And that's what they've done in this instance.
This almost feels too good to be true.
I mean, yes, that's fair. I think there are a bunch of issues here, right? And of course, the first one is researchers have got absolutely no idea what this underground cave looks like. You know, jagged rocks abound, so having a cave that's full of those will make it more difficult to potentially live there. And also, to get into it is a drop of over 100 meters.
Oh, okay.
And a bunch of steep slopes that, could potentially make avalanches happen for the people at the bottom. So it might be fanciful that this is the one. But of course, while this is N equals one, it does show that potential collapses of these tubes that form entrances to this underground world do exist.
Yeah.
And so I think researchers will be going back and looking a lot harder at previous data and looking for other evidence of this. But, you know, as we've said there, you know, it seems like lunar exploration is huge business right now for private companies and for various governments and nations around the world. So finding somewhere that folk could stay relatively safely, I think relatively is an important word to use there, would be a real boon for these missions moving forwards.
So no holiday to the moon just yet, but maybe in the future some research going on underneath the surface.
Yes, I mean, that seems like a reasonable thing to say, and also a reasonable place to end this briefing chat. Thank you, Emily, for making it your debut this week. And for listeners, for more on those stories and where you can sign up to get more like them directly to your inbox, check out the show notes for some links.
And that's all for this week. As always, you can keep in touch with us on X. We're at Nature Podcast. Or you can send an email to podcast@nature.com. I'm Emily Bates.
And I'm Benjamin Thompson. See you next time.
Thank you.
The Nature Podcast is supported by Nature Plus, a flexible monthly subscription that grants immediate online access to the science journal Nature and over 50 other journals from the Nature portfolio. More information at go.nature.com/plus.
They say opposites attract. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is the best bed for couples. You like a bed that feels firm, but they want soft? Sleep Number does that. You want to sleep cooler while they like to feel warm? Sleep Number does that too. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, during Sleep Number's biggest sale of the year, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed, plus special financing for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com. See store for details.